On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, I'm Shu Bartholomew. You're on the Commons, and joining us on the Commons today, I'm thrilled to have with us an old friend, Evan McKenzie. Professor McKenzie is the author of Privatopia and Beyond Privatopia, and he's been very busy doing all sorts of wonderful things, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about it. Evan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on, Shu. It's always a pleasure.
It's always fun having you, and there's always new stuff to learn from you.
I hope so.
So tell us, what have you been up to?
Well, what I've been working on recently, I'm working on a paper that's going to be presented at the Midwest Political Science Association in April here in Chicago. And later, I'm going to work it up into a bigger project on the failure of condominium associations, the collapse of condominium associations for various reasons. And it has many different parts to it. I'm looking at issues such as as I think I've said before, my view is that the whole institution, particularly of condominiums, and it to also homeowner associations, but condos are particularly hit with this problem, the problem of people really being unable to run them. In other words, that they depend too much on the resources of individual owners. They over-rely on the owners to run them, both in the terms of their financial resources and their loyalty to the association, their willingness to sacrifice time and energy and their own financial interests and so forth to keep the association going. So I think the institution as a whole is just really has some serious problems. And I'm looking at the things that have happened, such as financial collapse, collapse of the government, the private government due to failure of voluntarism, you know, people saying they don't want to serve an association, so the association just stops functioning, or it falls into the hands of very few people who misuse it because nobody is watching what they do because of the lack of participation, leading to fraud and mismanagement. And then, you know, this whole question of financial collapse, and I've been saying for many years that associations as a whole were headed for a period of financial crisis. I was saying this, you know, about 12, 13 years ago. And, of course, I did not anticipate the whole housing market failing as it did, but now that has really, that larger collapse of the housing market has accelerated the collapse of many associations financially for a variety of reasons. And so now I'm able to write about just one city, what's going on here in Chicago, and the failure of somewhere between 100 and 250 condominium associations, and there are many, many more than that. But I'm writing now about one small tip of the iceberg here, which is the 150 to 200 associations that have actually been taken over or are about to be taken over and placed in receivership by the circuit courts here. And so that's it's called the Illinois Distressed Condominium Property Act. That's the enabling legislation. I mean, it gives you some sense for how bad the situation is, that the Illinois State Legislature in 2010 actually, effective January 2010, actually passed a law that authorized the takeover of associations by the circuit court and placing them in receivership to dissolve them, to deconvert them and turn them back into apartment buildings. And I could tell you a bit more about that, but that's what I'm working on, and I'd be happy to explain any aspects of that for people.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I think Tyler Birding had been doing a lot of research and writing on this particular topic, and except that he was talking about the conversion from apartments into condominiums.
Right, but
And now you're doing it backwards. It's the condominiums that are being converted back into apartments.
Right, but it's the same process that Tyler is talking about. In other words, Tyler has been he's been very prophetic on this. He's been talking about this for years and years,
right,
and saying that there were large numbers of condominiums that were the result of condominium conversions. They were apartments being converted into condos, and that they were financially not viable. And he's been looking at what would happen in their life cycle as they accelerated toward being defunct, you know, toward being financially unsustainable for various reasons. What would happen to them? Well, what's happening here in Chicago is we have many, many examples of exactly what Tyler was talking about. Hundreds of condominium buildings that are in exactly the situation that he predicted associations would be in. What's different is that here in Chicago, the city is actually doing something about it. And if you go across, and I'll explain how this process works in a minute, but just if you'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, please do.
Because I think it's a fascinating program. But I think the most important thing to understand is that this is, as far as I can determine, the only city or county in the United States of America that is taking any responsibility for doing something about this. And what's happening elsewhere, if you go around the country, is the owners are just stuck. The owners who remain behind, who continue to live in a condominium, and in some cases it would be an HOA, but most of the problems of these condo buildings, the ones who stay behind and try to be good citizens and pay their assessments, keep the association running, they're the ones who suffer, because the units, when they have units in the building that go into foreclosure and the banks take them over, I have no numbers on this because nobody keeps accurate statistics on it. But
nobody wants the statistics, eh?
Nobody wants people to know actually how bad the situation is.
Yeah.
But banks often don't pay the assessments that they owe once they take the property over. They don't pay. Many, many times they don't do this. So they own the units. They might own 50-60% of the units in a building, and they're not paying assessments, various banks. So the burden falls on the resident owners to try to keep the place alive, to pay the utility bills and do the repairs and keep the building functioning. It's very, very difficult for them. And the normal process, in any place except Chicago, the only thing they can really hope for is that some private investor comes upon the scene and looks at the building and looks at all the vacant units and decides to buy them and take control of the building and the association. But people only do this. These are private investors or real estate syndicates, groups of people who have pooled their resources to buy up these units. And this is going on all over the country. But, sometimes these people like to be referred to as white knights. Other times they're referred to as vulture capitalists, but depends upon which way you look at what they're doing. And there are many different outcomes from that process. Notice that there's no real government oversight of this. That's what's different about Chicago. Ordinarily, there's no oversight of what these people do. It's all governed by these contracts, the declaration and the rules and regulations and so forth, and state condominium statutes. So they buy up a bunch of units, take control of the association, and then what do they do with it? Well, I have heard many different outcomes. Maybe they find the building profitable to rent out units and keep it as a condo building, but rent out a lot of the units. Maybe they try to rehab the building, make it look really nice, and sell the units, take over the developer's rights, if it's still at that point where that can still be done, and sell the rights as if they were the developer. Now, sell the units as if they were the developer. Now, that could happen. I hear other stories, though, of people really plundering these buildings and changing the declarations, amending the declarations using their unilateral powers because they control the association, amending the declaration so they don't have to pay assessments on the units that they own, and they shift the entire burden to the resident owners. And you hear all kinds of different stories about this.
Yeah, you do.
And municipalities, who are, as we all know, as we know, are heavily involved in creating this gigantic stock, this excess stock of condominium units. We have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of units, too many units of condominium housing, and too few units, at least in Chicago, too few units of affordable apartments because of this massive wave of conversions that took place during the housing boom. Well, who authorized that? And the answer is, for the most part, municipalities and also counties, but mostly municipalities. They gave builders permission to convert apartments into condos. They authorized them to sell them and on and on and on. They stood right there while all this happened. But now that the process has failed, the vast majority of local governments in this country are acting like they had nothing to do with it and have no responsibility for the current situation. And so the owners get stuck. And everybody says, well, you know, let the buyer beware.
You agreed, right?
What's that?
You agreed.
I agreed with what?
That's why you bought into it. You agreed to the terms of the condominium.
Oh, I see. Yeah, right. That's what they're saying to the person, that the buyer agreed. Yeah, exactly. You're supposed to have known every aspect of this transaction, but of course they didn't. And the whole process was, it was very, during the, let's say from 1995, 96, through about 2006 when the market began to fail at 10-year period in there, cities couldn't approve these conversions fast enough, or this new construction fast enough. And not only were far too many people put into far too many units of condo housing, not only were far too many units converted, but the quality of these buildings is another issue, and Tyler Birding has talked about this as well, but I think it's a well-known problem.
Yeah.
In many cases, these were old buildings that were cosmetically made to look new, but in reality, the infrastructure of the building, you know, the electricity, the plumbing, the elevators, and this sort of thing, a lot of that was really, the roofs, a lot of this stuff was really not very good, and the rehab was putting in new countertops and paint, and it looked really nice and new, but what was lying beneath the walls was really ready to collapse in many cases, and so a lot of these buildings now have major financial burdens that are hitting the owners, in addition to the foreclosures and the declining assessment revenues and the declining property values, the loss of home equity so nobody can borrow, and on and on. And then in the new construction, a lot of the newly constructed housing, certainly in many parts of the country, the newly constructed condo housing, certainly, a lot of these buildings, 50 years ago, if you showed a builder the things that were built in recent years and sold as townhomes and condos and stuff, a developer of 50 years ago would have looked at it and thought it was a movie set.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
They would have said, what is this, temporary housing? Is this supposed to look like a house? But it's, you know,
cardboard and scotch tape.
Yeah. And you know, basically sawdust and glue and...
Yeah.
And so... Even in new construction, there are all these plastic pipes and all this sort of thing. Really, a lot of what people bought just it either requires repair or it has a very short lifespan, a really short anticipated lifespan. So you either have defects in new construction or it won't stand up to the wear and tear of bad weather conditions or just the elements. And over time, not very much time, an awful lot of people find themselves bearing these financial burdens of their association at the worst possible time. You know, associations can't borrow money as easily as they used to. The owners don't have home equity to draw on, and assessment levels are often too low, and the result is people getting hit with these gigantic special assessments that they can't pay, and then people walk away. Well, you end up with these dilapidated buildings. Now, what happened here in Illinois was that, as I was saying, I think it's the only city I know that has really taken a systematic look at this issue and taken some responsibility for doing something about it. Because there were hundreds of buildings here in Chicago that had a variety of really serious problems. And so a law was passed, and I'll give you the basics of it. It's called the Illinois Distressed Condominium Property Act, and it is in the real estate code, in the Condominium Property Act, section 14.5 of the Illinois Condominium Property Act. So basically what it does is it identifies as distressed condominium property a parcel that has condo units that are operated in a way that constitute a danger, blight, or nuisance to the surrounding community or the general public. And the way they define that is it has to have two or more of the of six different conditions, two or more of them. One, this will just show you how bad this issue, how bad the situation was. Half or more of the units are not occupied by people who have the right to live there. In other words, more than half of the units are occupied by squatters. Second, serious building code violations. Not just little ones, serious violations. 60% of the units are in foreclosure. This is my favorite. There has been a recording of more condominium units on the parcel than physically exist.
What?
Yeah.
So what happened to the rest of them? They never existed.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, what was happening, actually, a lot of this had to do with fraud. And I can tell you more about that. But in many cases, these buildings were fraudulent conversions. And there are many cases of buildings that where they sold, where the converter was selling units. Let's say you have a building that has 12 units in the building, and they would sell 20.
But
they would sell units that didn't exist. They were taking pictures, you know, for the real estate listings of completely different buildings and claimed they had rehabbed the building. Oh, look at the beautiful marble countertops. Look at the bay windows. Look at the lovely appliances. When they weren't even pictures of the building. They hadn't rehabbed anything. It's just an old dilapidated apartment building, and they would just list, you know, 20, 30 units in a building that might have 10 or 12, and investors were buying them. And then
sight unseen.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the appraisers, I actually talked to an appraiser about this. I was trying to figure out, I said, how do you get past the appraisal with a thing like this? I mean, wouldn't the appraiser go out and look at the unit and say, wait a minute.
Should, yeah.
Unit 126 doesn't exist. It only goes to unit 120, you know? But, no, you know what they were doing? The appraisers, this is what I've been told, at least. Appraisers were doing what they call drive-by appraisals. They were driving past the building, looking at the building, say, oh, that looks fine, and writing down that they had appraised the unit when actually all they did was look at the building from the outside.
Wow.
Pretty shocking, huh? And so that's four of them. And then fifth would be the utilities are shut off to the building or 40% of the units. And lastly, 60% of the units or more are delinquent on their property taxes. So it has to have the building has to have at least two of those. And you can just imagine, Shu, how bad a building would be to have two of those, right?
Wow.
I mean, those are pretty bad. And if that happens, then what happens is the city, the municipality, which in this case is the city of Chicago, because the instigation for this, the impetus for this, came from the Chicago Corporation Council, the Chicago City Attorney. They have specialists who work on housing-related issues. They have a program called the Troubled Buildings Initiative that is done in conjunction with an outfit called the Community Investment Corporation, CIC. And between the city attorney and CIC, they have for many years now been trying to address the problem of blighted apartment buildings in Chicago. And they have managed to rehab over 500 apartment buildings over the years. But what they discovered around about 2005, 2006, and going into 2007, which is when they started addressing the condo problem, they began to discover that there were all these condo buildings that were presenting the same kinds of problems as slum apartments. Dilapidated apartments had offered in the past, but the problems were completely different because with condominium ownership, of course, the ownership is divided all over the place. You've got some owners in possession. You've got maybe half a dozen different banks, and who the heck can tell who owns the mortgage, you know? You've got second mortgages and all this stuff, and the ownership is just blown into many, many pieces. And so they had to find a completely different way to approach these buildings. And this piece of legislation came as a result of CIC and the city of Chicago getting together and getting the state legislature to pass this law. And so it allows the city to go through the city attorney to go into the housing court, the circuit court. Now this would be anywhere in the state, but this is mainly going on in the city of Chicago. Go into the circuit court, the housing court, and say, here's the building, and we petition the court. Here's the evidence that it is in two or more of these criteria are satisfied. And we petition the court to appoint a receiver. And in nearly all cases, the receiver will be Community Investment Corporation. CIC is a not-for-profit corporation that was set up in the 1970s by banks. It's basically a not-for-profit affordable housing lender. And so CIC has staff people who go out and find all the owners of all the little bits and pieces of this building, the unit owners, the banks, the first mortgage, the second mortgage, the lien holders, you know, the property taxes, all the different people who have it, and they get it all packaged together, and they convince the banks to take ultimately less than they want for the unit, because if they foreclose, they're saying, wait a minute, you know, we have a mortgage of $200,000 on this unit, and CIC gets them to see reason on this. You see? It isn't worth it. You're not going to get $200,000 out of this unit.
Yeah.
Banks, it's kind of like basically a short sale. But I mean, banks nationwide, as you probably know, are in the business of denying reality.
Right.
Concerning the value of the properties that they hold. And banks hold millions of second mortgages, for example, on properties. And those second mortgages are not backed by home equity. They are completely valueless. The home is underwater on the first mortgage. The second mortgage is actually valueless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they continue to pretend and keep this on their books as if this mortgage had some value and as someday they were going to get paid back, when there's no chance of them getting paid back.
Dream on, kiddos, right?
Right, right. And this is the banks, you know, this is their, they act like this with individuals. But with CIC and the city and the housing court behind them, the banks can actually be persuaded to become just simply realistic about this. And so they put together a package. CIC puts together a package by which all these people get, these institutions get paid off some fraction of what they want. But they get something as opposed to nothing. And the court approves eventually the deconversion of the building. It's no longer a condominium. It becomes an apartment building. All the owners get something. And the building becomes an apartment building. And they actually take bids, and the part of this process, this package they put together, is to decide who the new building owner is going to be. It'll be, you know, someone who's going to operate it as an apartment. And so they take bids on it, and the judge then decides who the buyer will be. And it will be based not just on do you have the money to buy it, but on what they intend to do with it and what kind of whether they think they'll be and behave responsibly. And, you know, big difference here. Look what's happening in other cities around the country when a venture capitalist comes in and on his or her own just buys all these units. There's no oversight to see whether what they do with the building is in anybody's interest other than his or hers. Whereas in Chicago, there's a judge looking at it and saying, "No, let's see what's going on here." And CIC is a not-for-profit that is always interested in high-quality, affordable housing. So you see, you know, my view of it is that this is a really fascinating program, and I think it's probably good for all concerned. But I can't find any evidence that there is such a program in effect anywhere else. To the best of my knowledge, there is not.
I have not heard of one, but... So we're taking, okay, now we're taking condominiums and converting them into apartments.
Correct.
And so we're back into the rental market.
That's right. That's right, exactly.
Okay. I have a question for you. You know, you gave out a list of six different scenarios, and this new law kicks in if the building has at least two of the six.
Correct.
But suppose you had a building with only one, like half of or more of the occupants were squatters. I mean, you know, that seems incredible.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I know, but...
So they continue to stay there.
Sorry, go ahead.
They continue to stay there, right? That's not an issue.
Well, you know, the reason... As I look at this situation, I think we're simply identifying the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah,
that these are really bad buildings. Now, there are, and it's not all the bad buildings. It's some of the bad buildings. At least Chicago is dealing with some of them. Right now, I believe they have approximately 150 buildings that have gone through the process or in it or are in the process right now. But they think there could be at least there could be maybe another 100 or more that might end up in the process. It's not clear. So maybe in Chicago there'll be 250 buildings total, or maybe not. Maybe it'll be more than that. But what if the building isn't that bad? Now, you see, there's different approaches here. In most cities, if the building, in order for one of these private venture capitalist type people, and the same thing, by the way, happens in Chicago all the time. It certainly does happen here. It's just that in Chicago, there's the option the city has of invoking this process. In any other city, there's no framework in place for doing it. But it can be done. You can appoint a receiver if there's litigation. I mean, it's not that it's impossible. Receivers have been appointed for other condo buildings in other cities. But what I mean is there's no formal program in place in any other city that I know of. And but normally, for private investors to get involved with this, they have to be thinking that the cost-benefit analysis, the risk-to-reward analysis, is in their favor. So they have to be thinking, how much money has to be put into this building to make it marketable, either as condos or, if they're going to deconvert it, as apartments? How much money has to go into the building? And, you know, if the building is too far gone, it may be impossible to get private investors interested in it. And so it's kind of an advantage that you have a program like this where the city can look at something that's likely to become a blight on a neighborhood and take that over. And then if the building's a little nicer, it's not quite that bad, then you might hope that private investors would get involved. Another option that has been used a few times, and Tyler Birding has written about this, is eminent domain. That is, if a building or a project is completely out of control, that has already become a blight on the community in a really serious way, there have been examples of redevelopment agencies that are, you know, public-private partnerships, so to speak, redevelopment agencies that have eminent domain power. And so, some redevelopment agencies have eminent domain power. They can actually purchase the building themselves. And instead of trying to unify ownership functioning as a receiver and then get someone to buy it once the ownership is unified, they can actually buy the building and redevelop it. Now, the problem now, that has been done a few times in the past. A couple of times in California that Tyler Birding wrote about in some of his publications. He explained how that all worked. Now, that is a process that requires resources, because that means the local government agency, whether it be the city or the redevelopment agency backed by the city, has to have the capital to purchase the property. And this then points to another growing problem. And that is the increasingly imperiled finances of local governments. You know, they need cash to buy these things, and somebody has to come up with the money. And right now, municipalities are struggling all over the country.
They always are, aren't they?
What's that?
They always are struggling.
Well,
or at least they say they are.
If you went back 10 years, you would find people saying that municipalities were in pretty good financial shape. Sure, since they've been under property tax pressure. In other words, starting in the late 70s, there was a lot of increasing property tax resistance. And that's the main source of revenues for local governments. And, of course, you know, we know about Proposition 13 in California and tax caps that were adopted around the country, and a lot of reforms that made it harder for cities to raise property taxes, in some cases other taxes. There were tax caps on income tax and other things. But for the most part, municipalities have found ways around some of those challenges. But
they've
now,
created associations, Evan.
Well, absolutely. That's one of the things they did, was they began to say, let's make sure that all the new construction is in common interest housing, because then we get hugely increased property tax payments, and we don't have to do very much, we don't have to pay for very much to get this type of housing. So this is one of the ways they've painted themselves into this corner now, because they promoted this type of housing as one of the clever ways they responded to their fiscal challenges. But there are other problems, because a large share of local government finance, meaning cities and counties, has always been intergovernmental transfers of money, either from the state or the federal government, you know, grants of one sort or another, or transfers of money. Well, that's imperiled. I mean, certainly from the federal government, a lot of these programs are gone, and or declining or threatened. Same thing with state aid. Cities got a huge windfall from the tobacco litigation. A lot of them did. They got a lot of the money that went to the states, the state attorneys general that handled that litigation. A lot of that went down to municipalities. Well, what's happening now, to make a long story short, is cities are getting hit with all kinds of unfunded mandates in the areas, and not just cities, but local governments, including school districts. They're getting hit with unfunded mandates in education, in health, and all sorts of other things. The revenue sources they depended on, like property tax, are declining because of declining assessments, lack of new construction. The housing market has basically collapsed. They shifted over to greater reliance on fees for service, and now people aren't buying the things that they used to charge the fees for because they can't afford it. Income tax is down. Sales tax receipts are down. Every source of revenue they have is imperiled. And this is happening, you see, so at a time when all this housing that we've been talking about is in the same kind of financial crisis.
Yeah, and it's the same people everybody's going to, whether it's the condominium or the government. It's always the homeowner, the citizen, and they're the ones who are supposed to squeeze out the money to satisfy everybody else's wants and needs.
Right. And we're going back to the same pockets.
Yes.
To bail out. Now, so if you look at the parts of the country that relied heavily during the housing boom and even before that on common interest housing as a cash cow, now those developments, a lot of them, are headed for financial trouble if they're not already in it. And the cities that sponsored this, that approved this strategy, they themselves are facing financial problems. So where's the money to come from to do things like eminent domain and redevelop things? Where is the money supposed to come from when the owners, who are also voters, start demanding, for example, that the cities take over their private streets because they can't afford to fix them, or take over their private lake because they can't afford to dredge it because of the EPA, and on and on. Who's going to bail these people out? Because everyone wants to reach into the same pockets, which is the taxpayers, and they are the same people who are the assessment payers.
Right.
And this is all kind of, these trends are all headed in the same direction, unfortunately, which is troubling. Now, that's why I look at a program like this, the CIC and the Illinois Distressed Condominium Property Act, and I say, you know, this is smart. It's smart to put something like this in place so you can do these things in an orderly way where you tie up the loose ends, you make the ownership clear, you avoid a bunch of stupid litigation, you prevent the destruction of neighborhoods through blight. And, you know, you could go on and on. There's lots of good things to say about this, I think. But what puzzles me, Shu, is why is this approach or some approach like it not being adopted in states all across the country? Don't people see that both private and public local governments are under terrible fiscal strain, and that the very same people, the owners, the citizens, the taxpayers, the assessment payers, those people are the only ones who are presently in the crosshairs of having to do all to solve all this on their own, using their own resources? Don't they see that there has to be some kind of an institutional response to this financial crisis that is now hitting associations? I mean, you know, first it hit individual owners. They lost home equity. They began to lose their homes in foreclosure. And everyone's reported on that. But there's been relatively little, some reporting, but relatively little reporting on the impact of the housing collapse on the associations. And that, of course, is going to come later. It is coming now. It is going to, I think, accelerate. Because the association is a corporate entity that has the ability to assess all the owners. And it has professionals working for it, and they've been able to prop these things up and keep a lot of them functioning. And, of course, a lot of associations will have weathered the whole thing fine, and they'll be all right. But there are thousands upon thousands of other associations with maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of people living in them that are deep trouble. And I just don't understand why there isn't a greater institutional response, particularly from state governments, to do something about these associations, because ultimately these associations are resting on the shoulders of the owners who are willing to pay.
But that's the whole point, Evan. Nobody wants to deal with them. States don't want to deal with them. Local municipalities don't want to deal with them. They've kind of shunted their responsibilities off onto associations, onto the individuals. To come back now and say, oops, maybe we screwed up, you know, they're not about to say that. I'm surprised that Illinois has done this, and I think it's a great thing. I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I really think it is, and it's gotten to the point where, you know, there was a time when I would get calls from people. You know, this happens all the time. I get calls from people saying they have a problem with their association. And for many years, it was always, almost always, a problem about a conflict over life, you know?
Yeah.
Events of their lives, the flagpoles and the dogs and the swimming pools and the elections and the access to records. And, you know, it was that type of thing. And these days, I get so many calls about money, about finances.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to mistake the change that has taken place. These are the challenges people are facing now, and they're very serious. You know, you can see a solution. Obviously, nobody wants to get into a fight with their association over something stupid. And if you have time,
they're still doing it. They're still doing it.
Yeah, in some places they're still doing it. But nobody wants to get into a fight over something stupid. But you solving these financial problems, and the association runs out of money and demands $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 from every unit owner right away. What is the solution to that problem?
You know, the other thing too is, Evan, there's boards and associations are still not very transparent, because as you point out, we're hearing from people now, and it's about money. Sometimes they just want to know what's happening to their money, and board members are not willing to share that. They're telling them that it's none of their business. You are not entitled to this information. It's their money, but you're not entitled to know what we're doing with it.
Yes, well, I've heard a lot of those stories, too.
And so there's still a big problem about it. I mean, there's a lack of community. You know, CAI wants to call these things communities. But in a community, you sort of get together and you face your problems head on and you work together as a community. In associations, you've got some very serious problems. And instead of being open, being honest, they're fighting each other over stupid things. You may not record, you may not have access to the records, you may not see what we're doing. You know, they're still fighting over these things instead of saying, here are the issues.
Well, I know in Maryland and Virginia there have been cases recently where hundreds of thousands of attorney's fees were run up over very, very small violations.
Yeah.
And cases where the association, one big one, I guess, in Virginia, where the association lost after running up, what, $400,000 in attorney's fees?
Oh, we have two of those. In fact, two associations have declared bankruptcy because in Virginia, the law says the prevailing party is entitled to fees and costs. And in both cases, in Manchester Oaks and in Old Belhaven, the homeowners won, and they were entitled to collect fees and costs, and they did. And the associations in both cases had to declare bankruptcy. So much for protecting property values. And the things where they were stupid little things that, you know, that started the whole thing.
And you may be aware of another law that's pending in the Maryland legislature. Senate Bill, I believe it is 1036, which is sponsored by State Senator Muse. I'm sorry, it's 1062, SB 1062. It's up for hearing on the 26th committee hearing, Judicial Proceedings Committee. And this is a piece of legislation that would require that whenever an association is trying to impose attorney's fees on a unit owner in a lawsuit, it would have to show that there's a reasonable relationship between the amount or the issue that they're disputing and the amount of attorney's fees that are sought. So it would create a provision for possible judicial review of the amount of attorney's fees. So like if it's a collection of assessments, then there would be a rebuttable presumption that the fees are reasonable. You could still challenge it. You could still try to shift the burden and say, no, they're not reasonable. But if it's not for collection of assessments, the burden would always be on the association to show that the fees they are demanding were reasonable given the nature of the issue and the amount in controversy. And there's the reason is because Larry Holtzman is the attorney who's really, I think, been raising this issue in Maryland. And it involves a situation that he was involved with where, they're seeking an association is seeking something like $200,000 in attorney's fees, and or at least a lien for an enormous amount of money. It's in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands for what was originally a $225 towing charge. And it's a long, complicated story I won't get into, but this, you ask yourself, how can it be? I mean, how can there be a dispute where you have a few hundred dollars at stake and tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees? I mean, how can that be? And the answer is because the developers and their lawyers construct the contracts in a certain way, and you have associations and their lawyers who know about these fee-shifting provisions and who basically say, well, you know, we can, A, make an example of people and terrify them with the specter of hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney fees, because you're not just fighting over a few hundred dollars, now you're fighting over tens of or hundreds of thousands of dollars that you don't even have if you lose. So we can just keep you from disputing anything by threatening you with this. And the other aspect to it is the attorney is sitting there thinking, oh, I'd love to handle this case.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to get paid, and if all else fails, we'll sell the owner's unit and I'll get paid out of that. Yeah. Now, this is, you know, when these practices are defended, you hear all the associations shouldn't have to, all the owners shouldn't have to pay out of their pocket, you know, the normal rule in the United States being each litigant pays their own attorney. Well, the owners can't afford this. They're just a not-for-profit association, and if you have some transgressor or some scoff law, they shouldn't have to all pay just to enforce a simple rule because this person won't obey, you know. All right, well, I mean, in some cases that may be a valid argument. But what's happening here, as we all know, is there are many examples of lawyers getting rich off this.
Oh, yeah.
And for what? I mean, for what? Where
because
is the relationship between the good they're supposedly doing for the association and the community? Where is the benefit here that justifies them soaking an owner for hundreds of thousands of dollars of attorney's fees for an Obama for President sign that's allegedly 4 inches too wide or something?
But the thing is, they brought it into compliance. They cut the sign in half. You know, it's just, there's so much pettiness that goes on in associations. It's not even funny. In the Manchester Oaks case, which came down to whether or not homeowners were entitled to collect fees and costs, because CAI all of a sudden decided that no, the law does not apply to the homeowner. If you're the prevailing party, too bad. It's only the association
right.
that can collect.
Right.
And so
right.
this ended up going to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, you know, they are entitled to it because here's
right.
the way the law is written. But this started off over assigning parking spaces in a townhouse development unevenly. They were discriminating against half of the members who had garages. And the members said, wait a minute, you're discriminating against me. You cannot assign some of the common area to only some of the people and leave us out. And, you know, the association said that, too bad, go away, we're going to do what we want to do. The thing is that there has been a case before Sully Station. It was identical. So they took the case Sully Station to the board and said, look, here are the issues in Sully Station. Here's what the court said. Board, you are wrong. So the board sought a legal opinion. The attorney for the association said, you can't do that, board, don't do it. The board went ahead and did it. So the board went through and wasted all of this money when they were clearly told they couldn't do it. Insurance wouldn't cover them. The homeowners lose the money because you've got a board that just doesn't want to lose face, I guess. I don't know.
Well, that's always the question people ask, you know. They'll say, journalists ask this question all the time, as if I knew the answer, because I really don't know what to say. When they say, why do they do this?
Yes, sir.
And I don't understand it. And when you talk to our libertarian friends, they always try to argue that anything that associations do, whenever you point out these problems, they'll say, well, you know, a municipality could do the same thing. Well, yeah, sure, I mean, I can conceive of it. They have the powers to do crazy things like that, and every now and then they do. But there's something about associations and the people who govern them that seems to lead to far more of these really bizarre enforcement actions that you'd have to think hardly any municipal government would undertake. I mean, you just can't find that many examples of this type of craziness. And the way I keep explaining it is, it's a problem with the resource pool, of people who are willing to do this. You go into an association and you got a small number of people. And often, and even if it's a large number of people, it's a small number of people who are willing to serve. Municipal office is much more desirable than running your homeowner association. Municipal offices, even in small communities, they're more competitive. They attract, in most cases, almost all cases, a better quality of people than the pool. Not that all of them, I'm not saying all association directors are bad officials, some of them are very good, but I'm saying, on the whole, if you compare the talent pool that seeks public office And the talent pool that seeks to be on condo and homeowner association boards, there's a big difference, and it would jump right out at you if you had them side by side.
I think with a municipality, you have a little more oversight, and that's totally lacking in an HOA.
Well, that's the other thing. The other big factor that I keep talking about over the years, and it doesn't seem to get anywhere, but and that is the absence of institutional support. That's what I call it, including oversight. Cities are backed up by the profession of public administration, for example. All these public administrators, city managers and so forth, they have degrees in public administration. I defy anyone to look at the quality of the public administration profession and the schools around the country and then sit there and tell me that the training of property managers is in any way comparable.
But we're not talking about property
managers.
We're talking about board members. I mean, it's the board members ultimately. The buck stops with them.
Well, that's certainly, yes.
You know, and the whole concept of people managing or governing themselves, it's a failure. It's not working.
Well, I just think I'm comparing two different things here. First, I'm comparing the quality of people who seek to be board members with the quality of people who seek to really seek municipal public office. And I think as bad as many city officials are, the talent pool is much, much deeper.
Yeah.
And secondly, there's the professional management, the professionals, the institutional support. In the case of municipalities, they have their own chapter in the bankruptcy code, Chapter 9, for municipal bankruptcy, which can be very advantageous. And you see state governments either backing them up, bailing them out, lending institutions backing them up or bailing them out. In some cases, emergency managers being appointed, which often may not be a good process, but at least somebody else takes responsibility. In the case of condo and homeowner associations, it's, hey, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And the only people they can turn to are the professionals. Now, if they look at the management staff of an association, look at the property managers of this country, some of them are very good, but they're largely unregulated, even in the states where they now have to be licensed, which is not all states. But the training is nowhere near comparable to MPA programs given by major universities all over the country. That this profession has been around and the training has been around for 120 years. You cannot possibly tell me. It's a joke to suggest that property managers are anywhere near as competent as public administrators, as the ones who give professional advice to cities on budgeting and finance and all the other things that they do. And so the institutional support is simply not there. The talent pool is not there, and it always comes back to the owners. And then, as you said, Shu, when the owner says, hey, wait a minute, well, this is a terrible situation you put me in, you always hear, oh, well, guess what?
You agreed.
Contract. Contract. You should have foreseen everything that went wrong. You bought the whole thing. It's all on your shoulders. And the city and the developer is long gone. The city washes their hands of it. The state says, we don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing, there's no help on, hardly any help on conflict resolution, despite the fact there are factories for generating conflict. Nobody takes any responsibility, and the owner's stuck with it, and they say, oh, you should have known that.
You agreed to it. Nobody.
And my answer to that would be, if the owner should have foreseen it, how come you, the municipality, didn't foresee it?
Yeah.
How come the state didn't foresee it? How come the developer didn't foresee it? Are you telling me you foresaw it? You know?
Yep.
But the owner should have foreseen it.
The owner should have foreseen it. So basically, I think what we're saying is it's not working, right, Evan?
Well, I believe that there's a structural problem with common interest housing, as I said. There's a structural problem. Many associations are doing fine. If they've got the private resources and they're functioning well, more power to them. I hope they continue to function well. But there are far too many associations that are malfunctioning either politically or financially. Far too many.
Yeah.
And too many meaning they're causing a lot of suffering for a lot of the people who live in them. And now, as evidenced by the act that we've just been talking about, it's spilling over into the larger community.
Evan, I have a feeling that we could talk for another hour. And I'd like to get you back really soon to do just that. But we're out of time. I hate to say this.
It's a pleasure, Sue. It's always a pleasure. We'll do it again soon.
It's a fascinating topic, and I'm really interested in finding out more about how this is going to work in Chicago. So we'll keep in touch, and I hope you'll come back soon.
I will, and hopefully I'll have I'm seeking some data on this to crunch up and analyze, and hopefully I'll be able to tell you something about that next time we talk.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.